Main speaker for this evening, Ronald W. from Los Angeles.
Good evening. My name is Ronald White, and I'm an alcoholic. You know, it's a little bit disconcerting when you come to the meeting and the guy who asked you to come, Damien, shakes your hand out in the parking lot, and then he tells you he's going to another meeting. But I have known since I've gotten to Alcoholics Anonymous, you guys told me, don't be worried about the people who aren't there. Be concerned with the people who are there. And I understand that. Because all my life, I've always been concerned with those who are not there, as opposed to looking at what's right in front of me. And I could miss it. Happy birthday to the Gems. I want to thank Jeff for a great 10-minute pitch. I told him I hate him. He's not supposed to be that good. And it's funny. When he got up here, he said that he wasn't special. Well, I'm here to tell you I am. And he is, too. See, I know exactly what Jeff was talking about. I'm not unique, because I used to think that I was unique. I used to think that I was, you know, I was different than everybody else, that there was something special. But believe you me, if you be alcoholic like I am, and I'm standing before you one day at a time, clean and sober, since July the 14th of 1986. I know I got sober when I was two. When you hear my story, you'll know, oh, he's special. In the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, there's a chapter 7. It's a chapter called Working with Others. That's a chapter that's entirely devoted to our 12-step recovery. That's the step that says, having had a spiritual awakening, as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. And then in that chapter, it explains in detail how I'm supposed to share with the new man or woman what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like today. I go to lots of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's quite fashionable to go to meetings nowadays and hear people say, I'm not going to stay in no drunkalog. We all know how to drink. I want to talk about recovery, about the work, about the process, about the steps. And I think it's important that I talk about our planned program of action, about the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, our program for recovery. But you know something? I think it is probably even more important, more vital, that I share with you what I used to be like. Because I suspect there's somebody who is sitting in this room tonight looking at Ronald White, and I think I look kind of nice. I'm going to share it for the people on the tape. I'm wearing a nice, beautiful black suit with a black shirt, with a black tie, really, you know, inventive, right? Black on black in black, right? You know, and I stand about 6 feet four. I have this long, long flowing blonde hair, and it's just like, oh. See, on the tape, they go, why are they laughing? Right? You know, see, guys, because I'm an alcoholic. I always like to gussy things up. You know, I like to expound and expand. But you need to know this. There's somebody in the room who's looking at me tonight, and they think, he don't look like no alcoholic. Look at him. He looked like a preacher or a teacher. He looked like somebody maybe they invited from the Screen Actors Guild to come up and read a script, right? You know, and you might miss it. There's somebody who is in this room this night thinking they're not like me, that they don't have what it takes to be in Alcoholics Anonymous, that he must be special. They ask him to speak. Look at he all dressed up, he's smiling, people were shaking his hand and all that. He's different than me. I'm lost and alone. I'm in a recovery home, or I'm in the mission, or I'm in a little studio apartment. Nobody want to talk to me. Family don't want to see me. I've lost everything near and dear to me. I've crashed and burned everything that I've built up in this life. I don't have what it takes to make it now. I've relapsed 5 times. There's somebody in this room that is feeling lost and alone and apart from in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm here to tell you, welcome home. Welcome to the land of the living. I want to let you know that when I arrived on the doorstep of Alcoholics Anonymous, I wasn't wearing a nice black suit with a black tie. I was wearing a pair of gray corduroy. First, let me tell you where I was. I was standing in the lobby. It's a Monday morning, July the 14th of 1986. I'm standing in the lobby of a joint called the Harbor Light Center. It was a place run by the Salvation Army, located on what we in Los Angeles call the Nickel, 5th Street, Skid Row, downtown Los Angeles. The Salvation Army Harbor Light Center was an all-men's recovery center housing 150 beds for alcoholic men. I'm standing in the lobby being interviewed by this old black guy named George. And I'm not talking about no job interview, y'all. I'm talking about one of those intake interviews. You know, one of those to see if they're going to give you one of those beds. And they ask you those complex questions. You remember, right? Mr. White, how much do you drink? I was stunned, right? You know, I was like, you know, right? You know, and I mumbled my answer, and he says, you know, where do you, and as he's asking me these questions, I remember I was mumbling my answers as I was looking down at these dirty, holy, run-over tennis shoes that I'm wearing. I'm looking at these tennis shoes, y'all, because it felt like my chin was stapled to my chest. Because I was so ashamed of being there, I couldn't even look this dude in the eye. And George is asking me these questions that I'm mumbling my answers, and my eyes traveled up from these dirty tennis shoes up to these gray corduroy pants that I'm wearing. And the pants weren't fitting me nicely like this suit is this evening. The pants were kind of like hanging off of me. You know how the youngsters have a style of dress nowadays. Right? What do y'all call it? Sagging, right? Where they're showing the draws and they just... Well, I need to tell you, that wasn't the style back in 86. And I wasn't a youngster. I was 31 years old. But I'm a drunk. When I drink, I don't eat. So imagine me about 40 or 50 pounds lighter than I am this evening. I'm a small guy anyway. Drop 40 off me, I look like a skeleton. Cheeks sunk in, eyes popping out my head. I had a big black trench coat on that I was wearing. That, look, it sounds fancy. A trench coat. No, it was one of those seedy black Chester the Molester looking coats, right? Because I wore this coat everywhere I went because I didn't want you to see how malnourished I had become. Like you wouldn't notice the coat. I told you it was July in L.A., but I'm a drunk. I had a black baseball cap pulled tightly over my head because by now I have no personal hygiene. I've stopped bathing. I've stopped combing my hair. My head is all matted. My cap was my comb. And I had this stench on me. You know the smell that the drunk has on them when you've been drinking for years and you ain't bathing and you're wearing the same drawers that you've been wearing for weeks and it's gotten blacked and caked and you almost have to peel. Wait a minute. Don't judge me. Wait. Some of you guys in here know what I'm talking about. Wait, don't let me discriminate. Some of you women in here know what I'm talking about too. Because you see, I'm a drunk. I don't even see how George could stand in the same room as me that night because I smelled so bad. If you have the opportunity when this meeting is over to give me a hug or shake my hand, I want you to take a whiff. Right? And you see, I was not smiling nor laughing about my condition that morning because there was nothing that I felt happy about. As I stood in that lobby, hoping desperately that they would give me a bed. You see, it wasn't ever one of my dreams or aspirations to grow up at age 31 standing in the Harbor Light Center begging them for a bed. It wasn't one of the top 10 goals of my life to become a drunk. In fact, quite the opposite. I thought I could never become an alcoholic because, you see, the first resentment I had in my life was against my daddy because my father was a drunk. He was a wino. And I swore I would never grow up to be like him. I grew up in South Central Los Angeles in Watts with five brothers. You guys may have heard one of my brothers a couple of months ago. My brother Ralph came and shared with you guys. So any of the good stuff that he shared that I might copy, he copied it from me first, okay? You just happened to hear him first. Two-bedroom apartment, my mother and father with five brothers and I, six boys in the other bedroom. My father used to love to drink a fine little beverage called Ripple. Some of you guys may remember Ripple if you're old enough. It made it in the 50s and the 60s. Cheap wine. I don't know which one it was, but he smelled of it. Always had empty Ripple bottles lying around the house. He would come home, get paid on Friday, couldn't make it home until Sunday. When he made it home, he was always broke. When he came home and my mother would ask him what happened to him, how he couldn't bring home a dime, I remember he would cuss her out like she had done something wrong, and he made her cry. And when he made my mother cry, I looked at this dude with hatred. I hated him for being so weak, for being such a punk, for not loving us enough to bring home the money. I hated him for being an alcoholic. And I swore as I grew up in that little apartment on 108th and Central that I wouldn't grow up to be like him, that I would not drink. And I didn't. For the first 18 years of my life, I drank nothing. But you know something? Even while not drinking, I still suffered from what I've come to know as the ism of alcoholism. In the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, in the front portion of our book, they have something called the doctor's opinion. Where this doctor who worked with the co-founders of Alcoholics Anonymous wrote a letter they've included in our book, Dr. William Silkworth. Silky wrote in this letter that he had studied thousands of alcoholics coming through his hospital. And he had noticed from studying them they had certain things in common. One of the things he said they had in common is that they seemed to have what he called an allergic reaction to alcohol. When they drank, they seemed to crave more. But that wasn't what really interested me when I first read the doctor's opinion, because I told y'all, I didn't drink for the first 18 years of my life. But Dr. Silkworth wrote something else. He said, these alcoholic men and women, when not drinking, seem to suffer from feelings of being irritable, restless, and discontented, kind of not at ease with themselves, dis-ease. And I identified with that. Because you see, even before I've started drinking, I've always felt dis-ease. I've never felt comfortable in my skin. I've always felt apart from rather than a part of. I don't always share that I've always felt less than, because a lot of times I felt better than. But I've never felt the same as. And I've always grown up feeling like I was too damn short. Now, that may not be a big deal to nobody else in the room other than the short guys, but I've always had little man's complex. You know I've hit the growth spurt. What you see is what you get. You know, I was studying the podium, making sure it wasn't too tall before I got up here. You know, I'm 5'4 and a half, and that's right, a half. give me all mine, right, you know. I've always had this thing, not only about my height, but I was too small. I wasn't just a short guy, I was a skinny guy. And in my neighborhood, it wasn't cool to be little because all the guys judged each other's self-worth by how well they played sports, how athletically inclined they were. And I wasn't good at hitting the baseball or shooting hoops or throwing a football. And we would have pickup games in the alley behind our apartment. And all the guys would be in a circle waiting to get picked. We made the best two athletes had to be on opposite teams. And they pick, right? They say, I'll pick Jimmy, I'll take Bobby, and I'm waving my hands, right? And then they get down to the end, and it was always me and some fat guy. And somebody would say, all right, I'll take Ronnie. and they don't know how that made me feel inside, like I was less than, like I was a burden. I've always hated wearing glasses. I've worn glasses since the second grade, and you guys call me those names, you know, Four Eyes, Poindexter, Mr. Peabody, the Professor, you know. I've always hated being so black. And I don't mean being black, but damn it, so black. Even, you know, even black people say discriminated against me, right? You know, it's just like, I grew up in the 50s and in the 60s when I thought that the lighter your skin was, the handsomer you were or the prettier you were. And I didn't want to be white. I just wanted to be high yellow, you know, with good hair, right? You know, it's just like, I could go on and on sharing with you the things that I hated about myself, the things that had me imprisoned in my thinking. But I couldn't drink to escape from those feelings, so I had to find something else. And the thing that I discovered as I grew up in that little apartment on 108th and Central were books. I became addicted to reading. Libraries became my sanctuary because, you see, when I read, I escaped. And I was no longer on 108th and Central. I was transported to distant lands. I was somewhere in Europe, in Paris. I was a spy. I loved espionage novels because the heroes were always, you know, exciting and dangerous. And they knew karate. Fight! Look at that. No lessons, right? You know. And these novels made me feel good about myself. They helped me escape and feel important. But after a while, I understand, looking back on my experience in my life, anything that I've ever used that helped me escape, after a while of using it, it didn't seem to have the same effect it did in the beginning. And I seem to require more. My disease, it always requires more. And after a while, those novels didn't get me out of myself as quick or as fast, and I needed something else, and I discovered comic books because the stories were shorter and quicker, and the heroes were bigger and grander, right? They had a line of comics I discovered back in the day made by a company called DC. DC Comics made Superman and Batman, The Flash, Green Lantern, Green Arrow, Hawkman, The Atom, The Justice League of America. They had a book called The Legion of Superheroes. And Ronald became a superhero named Mon-El. I would go in my mother's closet and I would grab a towel and I put that towel around my neck and that towel became a cape. And I would run out on 108th Street and I'd get a running start and I'd jump and I'd fly down Central Avenue. Now, I don't know if you guys know anything about Watts in the 60s. One of the most hardcore, dangerous areas you could ever hope to grow up in. And you would have thought that I would have been scared of making a fool of myself running around the street with a towel around my neck. But you know something? When I put on that towel, when I put on that cape, I felt no fear. Because, you see, it made me feel strong. It made me feel heroic. It made me feel powerful. And even back then, lack of power was my dilemma. And I was willing to go to any length to feel the sense of power. Progressive disease. After a while of reading those comic books, they didn't fix me the way I need, because I started to feel kind of foolish running down the street with that towel on. And I needed something else. And my family purchased a small black and white television. This is the early 60s. And I fell in love with TV. They used to call me the human TV guide. I would be glued to the television and neighbors would come by. My brothers would play a little game. And they would say, hey, man, watch this. Ronnie, Wednesday, 8 o'clock. And without moving, I say, 8 o'clock, Channel 2 is Gunsmoke. Channel 4 is Mannix. Channel 5 is Donna Reed. Channel 7 is Petticoat Junction. Now, see, our younger members look very puzzled when I start saying those names and what have you. But some of our more mature members, I see some of y'all in here, they remember those shows Because these are the shows I grew up on that were on TV back in the 60s. I knew whatever was on any channel, any time of the day, any day of the week. Thank God they didn't have cable. Woo. There was one TV show that I gravitated to that later became one of the guiding forces in my life. And you guys may remember this TV show. It was called Perry Mason. Perry Mason was a show about a criminal defense attorney played by an actor named Raymond Burr. Raymond Burr was one of the handsomest guys I had ever seen on television. He was tall, broad-shouldered, jet black hair, slick back, beautiful black suits that he, I think they were black. It was black and white television. So, you know, dark suits that he had on, right? And he would walk around the courtroom with a command and a presence about him. And he had these dark, piercing eyes that he would fix on the witness stand. And at the end of every episode, Perry's client was in jeopardy, looked like they were about to go down for murder. And his private eye, Paul Drake, would run in the back door of the courtroom with a little slip of paper, right? And he'd hand it to Perry. And Perry would read that note, and he'd turn around and look at that witness, and the witness would get nervous. Start to get, right, sweat and fidget around. Perry wasn't having it, and he would just close in. And he was like, isn't it true? Yes! Right? Right? Somebody in the back of the courtroom would jump up. I did it! It was amazing, right? I don't think a case ever went to the jury, right? It was just like, and that's who I wanted to be. I wanted to be Perry Mason because, you see, Perry had power. He had the power to bend people's will to his simply by the force of his presence and his words, and I thought maybe I could do that. He wasn't somebody in a comic book with a cape on. He wasn't somebody in a novel over in Europe. He was a real man. I could see him on the television. That was my imagination. I thought he was real, and I thought maybe I could do that. So I grew up wanting to be Perry Mason. I wanted to be a lawyer. As I came through school, I was a straight-A student because my addiction to reading made me ready-made for school. I was the best reader in every class I was in. Teacher always called on me to read the lessons. I was the teacher's pet in every class. I was one of the original nerds. You guys know, you know, that's me, right? Honor roll, every school I went to, straight A's. I get to high school. I went to a high school in South Central Los Angeles called Locke High School. We had a marching band called the Locke High Saints, the Marching Saints. We were one of the best marching bands in the nation. We marched in the Rose Parade, and I was played trombone in that band, and I marched in the front rank, the front line of the band. We went to Hawaii and marched in the Aloha Parade. A few of us in that band formed a jazz band that went to the Hollywood Bowl for the Battle of the Bands, where we won sweepstakes as the best jazz band, high school jazz band in the nation. I got elected my senior class president in 1972 when I was a senior at Locke High School. I got accepted to go to college on a full academic scholarship at Loyola University. It's now Loyola Marymount University, a small private Jesuit school located in Westchester, just on the outskirts of Los Angeles. I need to let you know, it sounds like I had it going on, right? Sounds like I had some good things in my life, some blessings. Sound like I had some gifts, but you know something? I'm an alcoholic in waiting. Remember, I haven't even drank yet, but I still have the ism because, you see, I am so busy looking at your blessings, I can't even enjoy mine. For some reason, the grass has always appeared greener on the other side to me. Whenever I've strived to achieve anything, I might like it for a second, but I get tired of it real fast. And it doesn't seem to have the effect I thought it was going to have. And I have a disease of more. Even before I started drinking, I have always felt irritable, restless, and discontented. And that no matter what you give to me, it's not enough. And after all, I still know inside, even with these outside accomplishments, I still know who I am inwardly. I'm the guy who's never had sex. I'm the guy who doesn't know how to talk to girls. I'm the guy who goes to the dances at school, and when they don't do it nowadays, but back in the day when I was young and they had dances, all the guys and girls would be dancing to the fast records, and at the end of the dance, they always put on these slow records so the guys and the girls could get romantic. and we could get together, right? And they had an old R&B group back in the day called the Dells. And the Dells had a record out at the time called Stay in My Corner. And Stay in My Corner was long and it was slow. And they loved to put that on at the end of the dance. And they would put on Stay in My Corner, and all the guys would rush across the room to get a girl. And when they played Stay in My Corner, I'd be staying in my corner. Because, you see, I fear rejection so much that I won't even try if the answer might be no. Not if the answer is going to be, but if the answer might be no, I won't even try. And I've gone through life feeling like a fake and a phony and a fraud, pretending like I know what life is about, and inside being scared to death that you will discover I don't know. Hiding behind these grades with no experience with living. I graduated from Locke in 1972, and my class gave a beach party to celebrate our graduation. The beach party was given at night, and they set these trash cans on fire on the beach to light up the beach to make it look romantic. And I'm walking along this romantic beachside setting by myself with a can of soda, the professor. I tried to see how she would do that. Did she do it again? And I stopped because I saw a guy and a girl underneath a blanket, and I looked, and the blanket was moving. And I listened, and I heard the girl say, "Ooh." Excuse me. I got lost for a second. And I wanted to get underneath a blanket, but everybody knows I'm the professor. And the professor doesn't get underneath blankets. And somebody was passing around something, and I wish I remember what it was because it became my first drink. It was either some Tyrolia or some Spinata. High-class stuff. Cheap wine. Because, you see, by now my thinking told me that I could take a drink and I'd never become my father. My father was a high school dropout. I'm going to college on a full scholarship. I'm obviously smarter than him. My daddy was a janitor, a custodian. I'm going to be the next Perry Mason. I'm better than him. My thinking, my ego told me I could take a drink and I'd never become him. And so I drank. Probably only another alcoholic can truly understand the effect produced in me by alcohol. In the beginning, when it was working, alcohol made me feel taller. Alcohol made me feel bigger. Alcohol made my skin feel lighter. Alcohol made these glasses turn from these big plastic things that were on my face to these beautifully tailored wired frame glasses. Alcohol made my hand go in my pocket, and I kind of got this lean. Somebody in here know what I'm talking about. When you just finally felt like you could just go. And I just felt cool. This kid who was so square, who felt like he didn't fit in with the guys, all of a sudden, man, I felt a part of. And it worked. Alcohol made me feel like I was a part of a fellowship of men and women who shared their experience, strength, and drinks with each other. And I had found the fellowship that I craved. When I was at Loyola University, I drank, and I went to parties, and I danced, and I didn't feel apart from. I felt a part of. We went to the beer bus and the panty raids, and we did all at a... Yeah, y'all know what I'm talking about. And I felt a part of life at last. But guess what? I discovered in drinking, it was just like everything else I had done in life. I didn't want to just feel good at the parties on the weekends. I wanted to feel good on Monday, too. And I wanted to feel that way on Tuesday. My third year in college, I'm drinking every day now. and I'm starting to miss classes because daily drinking starts doing some things to you. I need to quickly let you know that respecting the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't share about all the other things that I use in addition to my drinking, but you need to know I'm a garbage can because I have the disease of more. I started missing classes in my third year. My character started to change because I still wanted to pass class, but I didn't want to stop drinking, so I had to do a shortcut. I start cheating on my exams. I start writing the answers on my cuffs, going to the bathroom in the middle of tests, looking at the answers. I start plagiarizing my term papers. Hell, I start buying my term papers from these services that used to sell them ready-made. The kid who was the straight arrow, who had been raised in church by this mother, all of a sudden, all the things and values and morals that I had, I start crossing each line because alcohol made its way to the top of the list. I graduated from college on time in 4 years by the grace of God and got accepted to go to law school, pursuing Perry Mason. I went to a law school in San Francisco called Hastings College of the Law, located in downtown San Francisco, an area known as the Tenderloin. It is what it sounds like, a haven for alcoholics, and I was at home. I did nothing but drink and party through my first 2 years of law school. Went to summer school after my first year, and summer school after my second year. I was a law clerk for a guy who was a drunk like me, and I thought, this must be how you do it. And I found a sponsor. Because I went to summer school after my first and second year, I graduated from law school early in 2.5 years, when I was 23 years old, before any of my classmates finished. They have a test you got to take to be a lawyer called the bar exam, and they were giving one before our graduation ceremony in May of 1979. And I thought, nobody passes it the first time, so why don't I take this first one as a practice, and when everybody gets out of school, I'll be ahead of the curve. Well, I took the test, and the results came out on the day of my graduation, the last Saturday in May of 1979. And as I'm in my apartment getting dressed in my cap and gown, getting ready to go to the ceremony, my family has flown up from Los Angeles for the ceremony. There's a banging on my door, and my best friend bursts into my apartment, and he yells, "Ronald, they just posted the bar results, and guess what? You passed." And at age 24, I become one of the youngest black attorneys ever licensed to practice law in the state of California. And I thought, I'm going to be the next Perry Mason. Isn't it true, right? You know, I know by the time I'm 30, I'm going to be a millionaire, right? I'm a boy wonder, a genius, right? I'm an alcoholic, is what I am. And believe you me, passing the bar the first time added fuel to the fire of my ego, and it took off. And by the time I was 30, I was not a millionaire. I didn't even have a bank account. By the time I was 30, I wasn't living in a condominium or a mansion or a house on the hill. I moved back into my mother's house, sleeping on one of her floors. By the time I was 30, I didn't have a nice job for a law firm on Wilshire and Westwood. The only job I had was carrying out the trash and watering the lawn for a 21-year-old dope dealer who lived across the street from my mother's house. I cannot even imagine the shame and degradation my mother must have felt when she had come outside and look across the street in her neighborhood and see her son virtually prostituting himself for a drink. You see, alcohol is no respecter of intellect. Alcohol doesn't care if you graduated from law school or if you dropped out from high school. Alcohol does not care if you grew up in Westwood or in Watts. Alcohol doesn't care if you're black or if you're white. Alcohol doesn't care if you're a man or if you're a woman. Alcohol is an equal opportunity ass kicker. Suffer from the illness, the disease that I suffer from, that is first of all physical in nature. There is a change that takes place in my body when I have one drink that is indescribable to anyone who's never felt it. There is a craving that starts in my body. It's like an itch that must be scratched. And I will do whatever it takes to scratch that itch, to get the next one. I don't care if you my mother. I was stealing the shoes out of my mother's closet. I stole food out of her refrigerator to cook plates for people around the neighborhood. My mother raised me and my brothers by herself. When she put my drunk of a father out when I was 9, my mother went to night school to get a diploma for high school while raising 6 boys and working, cooking, and cleaning for other people's families. My mother, when she got that high school diploma, she didn't want to just stop there because she wanted her boys to have more. So she took 2 jobs, going to night school to get a college degree. She got that college degree while being the president of the PTA, always had us in church every Sunday without a family car. We would catch the bus or get a ride with my grandparents, or somehow she was the perfect mother. And guess what? That woman who got, when she got this beautiful job and they gave her a gold watch, I'm the one that stole the watch for a drink. The craving knows nothing about love, honor, trust, respect. Let me have one. I will do unimaginable things. But that's not the worst of my illness, because you see, the solution is don't have the first one. But there's something about my thinking that is different than normal people. It's described in chapter 3 of the big book as an obsession, a thought that overrules all rational thought, that constantly whispers to me, Ronald, this time it'll be different. Don't always say it that way. Sometimes it simply says, just change what you drink, Ronald. Change where you drink. Change who you drink with. Put your money in money orders and mail it back to yourself. Give your money to your mother to hold for you. Dude, see, these are the thoughts I had before I got started. There's no craving taking place. These are the plans I try to make to protect me from me. Insanity, unable to see the true from the false. And until I could address the third part of my illness, that dis-ease of my spirit, the soul sickness, that malady that has always made me feel less than, better than, different from, until I could deal with that, I am doomed to seek ease and comfort where I used to get it from alcohol. Because the obsession will make me think that this time it'll be different. On July the 13th of 1986, I burned a guy out of some money, and he was a dangerous guy. He lived a few doors down from my mother. It was a Sunday, and he wanted his money back. And I had a bright idea. I said, let me take him in my mother's house, and he won't do anything to me. My mother had just gotten home from church. So I take this wolf in my mother's house, unmindful of her welfare. And I go in and I'm telling him, Kenny, I'm sorry I don't have your money. And Kenny has a bright idea. He says, Ronnie, it's fine. Why don't we just make credit arrangements to get the money back? And I'm thinking, I got over one more time. And he says, let's step out on the porch. And I didn't see the signals. And so he stepped out and I started stepping out behind him, looking back, making sure my mother was close enough to see us. I've become a coward, hiding behind my mother, and Kenny is waiting on me. And when I stepped out that door, he must have hit me as hard as he possibly could. And I found myself flying across my mother's front yard like one of those superheroes without a cape. And I landed on the grass, and Kenny proceeded to run over and started kicking me in the head, stomping me, trying to kill me. As he was doing this, I felt as if I were removed from my body, watching this happen. And I'm looking at Kenny kicking and stomping me, and I looked over and my mother stepped out of the house on the porch, and I expected her to say, stop, stop, that's my baby. But she said nothing. And I look back at Kenny, and he's still kicking me and stomping me. And I look back at Mama, and she turned around and she walked back in the house and she closed the door. And it was at that moment that I experienced step one. Some of our more cynical members in Alcoholics Anonymous like to say it was probably just a concussion, but I like to think that was a spiritual experience for me, because you see, at that moment I knew that I was whooped. The next day is when I went to the Harbor Light Center in the state I described to you at the beginning of this meeting. And they gave me a bed, and I did nothing but eat and sleep for the next 7 days while they detoxed me. And then they started bringing me to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, where I started listening to people share from podiums like I am this evening, that I would come, and then I would come to. And then I would come to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. The spiritual solution to my spiritual problem. Step 2 in the program of recovery. And they told me that many of them, men and women, just as I had been, had discovered a power in their lives, a power greater than themselves. And then many of them called this power God. And when I heard that, I thought I was lost, because I had tried to get sober in church. And I would always relapse. And I thought the God that I knew of was a punishing God. Because after all, wasn't the evidence of my life proof that all the recklessness, all the cheating and the lying that I had been doing in my life had earned me this life? And they told me, Ronald, guess what? Who do you think had carried you through that madness? Who do you think has brought you to this place? We have a chapter for you, Ronald. It's a chapter called We Agnostics, chapter 4. The spiritual kindergarten. And they told me within the pages of that chapter that I needed to strip away everything that I thought I knew about this power, that maybe I've been looking for this God through somebody else's eyes. And they said, you need to have a personal relationship, a God of your own understanding. And they pointed me to a line in that chapter that I love so much that says this: deep inside every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God, that he has sometimes been obscured by calamity, by pomp, by worship of other things. But it tells me there that if I am willing to search fearlessly within myself, we believe it is only there that he can be found, and I got hope. Because I've always searched for God in the sky, in a preacher, in my mother, and somebody else who seems so much more godly, so much more worthy than me. Because after all, I know me. What God would want to reside in this animal? They told me, Ronald, you have just piled so much garbage on top of the sunshine of your spirit, but we have a prescription that will uncover, discover, and discard the garbage you placed on top of that power, and we call them steps. And we promise you, Ronald, that if you're willing to take these steps and apply them in your life to the best of your ability, we promise you, you will have an awakening of your spirit as the result of these steps. And I got hope. I was in the Harbor Light Center for 130 days, and they took me to a second phase of their recovery program of sober living called Harmony Hall. By now, I thought that I didn't have a law license anymore. I thought I had been disbarred because I had been practicing law without a license. Well, always drank up my bar dues. And so I thought when I got sober, I could never be an attorney. So when I went to Harmony Hall, the sober living, I was just going to be satisfied with whatever part-time work I could find. First job I found was a part-time job being a bookkeeper for a little old lady who had a nursing home. Let me share with you what I would do. I would go over her house. I would catch the bus there, and she would sit me in her living room, give me a stack of her bills, and she took her checkbook, and she signed a bunch of blank checks. And she gave that checkbook to me, and she said, Mr. White, I want you to pay all my bills for me and balance my checkbook, and I'll be back in a couple of hours. And she left me alone in her house with a bunch of blank signed checks. And I'm 5 months sober, and I'm scared. When she came home, I was sitting in the same spot where she had left me. And I gave her her bills, and they were all sealed up with checks inside. And I gave her her checkbook back, and there were no checks missing. And there was nothing missing in her house. And that lady paid me $40 a week to do that job. And when I caught the bus back to Harmony Hall with that $40 in my pocket, I felt 10 feet tall. Because it had been a long time since anybody had trusted me. And I hadn't burned them. And I knew there was something about that spirit that had gotten so sick when I had started drinking was changing. And I grew closer to the power. When I was 10 months sober, they put me out of the sober living because I was taking up space for somebody who needed to come over from Harbor Light. I was hiding out, scared to go home. And a lady with a panel of Alcoholics Anonymous in that sober living heard me share about that fear. And she came up to me at the end of the meeting, and she says, Ronald, you could move into my apartment with me and my roommate Jenny and sleep on our couch until you get a home group and you feel comfortable enough to move back to your mom's house. And you know what I heard was, I want you. You know how attractive we are when we're 10 months sober. Thank God I don't have to act on my thinking. I went to that lady's house, and she let me sleep on that couch, and I never approached her, didn't disrespect her. She gave me a key to that apartment, and I caught the bus to meetings and to work, and she taught me the meaning of trust and unconditional love. and I grew closer to the power. When I was a year and a half sober, somebody in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous hearing me share from meetings how the program works, keep coming back, approached me after the meeting, says, Ronald, you talk about how you trust in God. Why don't you call the state bar and find out what's happening with your bar card? Living in fear in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I called the state bar. They said I had been suspended for non-payment of dues, but I hadn't been disbarred. If I pay all my back dues, $2,500, they'd give me my bar card back. $2,500 sounded like $25,000. I had a minimum wage job, but it's amazing how much money you could save when you're not drinking. Save half of every paycheck for the next 6 months, and I wrote a check for $2,500 to the State Bar of California. They gave me my bar card back. Somebody else in the room says after a couple of months, Ronald, isn't it time for you to apply for a job as a lawyer? Still living in fear in the rooms, afraid of sending out that resume. You know how we got that gap on there when we get sober. They said, Ronald, just put down the jobs you work at as a lawyer and trust in God. First job I applied for was with the L.A. County Public Defender's Office. They were interviewing, and they had me over. And they asked me these questions at the interview. And the smart lawyer at the end said, Mr. White, we noticed you haven't been practicing law for the last 2 years. Why not? I said, sir, I'm an alcoholic. I didn't intend on telling them. I said, I'm an alcoholic. I've been sober for the last 2 years. They said, Mr. White, lawyers drink a lot. Don't you think the stresses of this position might make you want to drink again, sir? I said, it was stressful when I was out there. I said, I think God has prepared me to do this job. They looked at me, God, who is that? Is that a reference? They don't hear that in job interviews a lot. He said, all right, Mr. White, we'll let you know if you're on the waiting list or if we can hire you. I went home that day, and they called me a few hours later, said they wanted me for another interview that Friday. I said, shoot, probably want me to pee in a bottle, but I'm willing. I'm sober. When I showed up that Friday, they had me see the head public defender of all Los Angeles County, a guy named Wilbur Littlefield. Mr. Littlefield set me on a couch, and he started walking around talking about what public defenders do, and I'm expecting him to question me about the alcohol, but he asked me no questions about alcohol. He just stopped talking after a while, and he gave me a funny look. And he walked over to the couch where I sat, and he held his hand out to me. And he said, Ron, we'd be proud to have you join our office. Didn't he know just 2 years before I was sleeping on my mother's floor, stealing the shoes out her closet, carrying out the trash for a dope dealer? What is that but a miracle? Alcoholics Anonymous takes broken up pieces of men and women working with the guidance of a loving God who works through the unselfish men and women who toil. In this fellowship, we put the pieces back together again. It was as if each man and woman who sits in this room tonight were standing in the lobby of the Harbor Light Center when I arrived there, more dead than alive, with my chin on my chest, too ashamed to look you in the face, and you guys walked up to me. And you placed your hand underneath my chin, and you lifted up my head. And even more than that, you wrapped your arms around me. As dirty and as filthy and as nasty as I was, you wrap your arms around me and you literally love me back to life. Damn. That's Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous is not about who's got the best pitch from the podium. It's not about who's wearing the nicest suits, who's got the biggest car in the parking lot, who's got the most babies. Alcoholics Anonymous is about gaining access to the power. The power that I've come to know that is so great, so good, so forgiving, so loving, it can do anything but fail. He's telling me my time is up, so I can't tell you a few things about what it's like today. Take a minute. Can I have one more minute? February the 8th, 1991. I found myself standing in the delivery room of Kaiser Hospital in West Los Angeles with a pair of scissors in my hand, cutting the umbilical cord on my son, Ronald Jr. No ego. I may have had it backwards, but 3 months later, I had the opportunity to marry the mother of my son, a guy who was only a trick when he was drinking, and a woman actually wanted to share her life with me. Alcoholics Anonymous. When I was 12 years sober, I was invited to the White House by the President of the United States because he heard about the work I was doing in my community as a public defender at the time. Standing on the lawn of the White House, hell, I was watering the lawn for the dope man. I'll leave you with this. In November of 1987, on a Sunday morning, my mother walked out of her bedroom getting ready to go to church. She was dressed beautifully in church clothes, almost the same way she was dressed the day that guy Kenny tried to beat me to death. As she stepped in the doorway of her living room, she stopped and she looked around the living room and she starts to cry. My mother starts crying because the living room was full of drunks. And each one of the drunks sitting in that living room that morning were holding a copy of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous in their hands. Because my brothers and I, who had gotten sober in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, had been able to start a big book workshop in the same house that we tried to drink my mother to death. And the tears my mother cried that morning were tears of joy for what the program of Alcoholics Anonymous had done for her and her boys. That's Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you for letting me share.